All right. Hello, everyone. First of all, I'd like to start off by saying thank you to the organizers for organizing such an unusual and interesting conference. I wish all conferences could be as interesting as this one. So I'm going to talk about ultralight hidden photons. Hidden photons are a new possible particle. They are a new force carrier. They're a new dark matter candidate. They might be the link between the Standard Model and new hidden sectors. And they're a particle that you can do some neat experiments to search for. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about some searches. This is work I've been doing with Peter and Sujit, who are here, and Yue Zhao, who's another postdoc at Stanford. We're theorists. With theorists, they get unusually excited about thinking about experiments. So we've been working closely with these experimentalists here to design and hopefully operate the experiments that I'm going to tell you about. In particular, Sami Tantawi is amazing with high-Q electromagnetic cavities. And Kent Irwin is amazing at detecting incredibly small electromagnetic signals, and you'll see shortly why those are important. But first, let me introduce hidden photons from a sort of big picture theory point of view. Here's the Standard Model. At the bottom, the stable particles that make up all of the matter that we see, and above them, the tower of short-lived particles. And here's nature as particle theorists would like to imagine it. We'd like to imagine that there's much more going on than just a Standard Model. And we have good reason to imagine that perhaps there's new physics at high energies extending the Standard Model, and that's traditionally where particle theorists have focused their attention. But we also have good theoretical reasons to imagine that maybe there are many other particles at many other mass scales residing in hidden sectors that are very decoupled from the Standard Model. And at the very least, dark matter has to fit into this picture somewhere. That's one very good reason to think there should be new physics somewhere. And the more we fail to discover new physics at the TEV in high energy experiments, the more I think we should be motivated to try and probe these potential hidden sectors with new low energy physics. And then the question becomes, what are the ways in which our low-energy Standard Model particles might couple to low-mass, low-energy hidden sectors? And what are the couplings that might be biggest and that might be most easy for us to probe in experiments? And one direction this certainly points you to is axions, which could be connected to some hidden sector but coupled to the Standard Model. But there's one particular coupling which stands out as being the only coupling which isn't from a higher dimension operator, which isn't suppressed by some heavy mass scale. And that coupling is a kinetic mixing of the photon with a photon-like particle in a hidden sector. And it's really unique in that regard. It's the only non-higher dimensional coupling that can couple us to hidden sectors. And that makes it, that's one reason why it's particularly interesting to think about looking for hidden photons. So that's the sort of top-down picture. Let me tell you more specifically now what a hidden photon is. So in particle theorist language, a hidden photon is a new U1 prime gauge boson that has some kinetic mixing with the photon.
Why did I write 2 epsilon and not 1/2 epsilon?
Because I made a mistake. Because I made a mistake. Should I say it louder? I made a mistake. Yes. So the kinetic mixing is controlled by the parameter epsilon, which can naturally be anything from order one down to incredibly small. There's really a huge range it can naturally lie in. And in general, a hidden photon can also have a small mass. That mass is technically natural, which means that it can be arbitrarily small without there being a hierarchy problem. And I'm going to be thinking about very small masses. When I say ultralight hidden photons, I mean masses which correspond to Compton lengths which are macroscopically big. So they're very interesting to probe in lab experiments.
Jeremy, quick question. You said that it's a mixing of a photon with something, but you write it like a separate thing. Why do you say mixing? Would, for example, a photon have a component of a dark photon?
That actually turns out to be a sort of basis choice question. So in some sense, yes, and in other senses, no. And actually, let me not get into that subtle question. But we call this, so the standard model, that the photon Lagrangian has a f mu nu, f mu nu. And the hidden photon has a f prime mu nu, f prime mu nu. And then we call this term, that's f mu nu, f prime mu nu, in the kinetic mixing. David?
Is the mass trace purely phenomenological, or is there a reason that it couldn't be like very heavy?
It could certainly be very heavy, but then we wouldn't be probing it in low energy experiments. So that's why I'm going to be thinking right now about. And there's, you know, of course, as you know, we're trying to probe it over many, many, many orders of magnitude of mass, and I'm going to be talking about some of the lowest masses that we can probe. So that's the particle physics picture. To an experimentalist or someone a little more practical, this hidden photon is a new force carrier. That new force is basically a second copy of electromagnetism, with the difference that it has a finite range set by the mass, and it's very weakly coupled to us. So whereas electromagnetism has a photon with a coupling strength E, there's an electromagnetism prime, if you will, with this massive hidden photon that couples in exactly the same form to charge, but with a coupling suppressed by this parameter epsilon.
Why it's exactly the same epsilon as that one?
Up to the missing factor of a quarter, which Maxime pointed out, you can. I won't go through the steps now, but if you just put in the coupling of the coupling of the photon to the electric current, you do a diagonalization of the Lagrangian, and it just pops out. This result just pops out. Okay, so where does this lead us experimentally? Well, I have a new long range force, which is coupling to charge. So I might see a modification of electromagnetism. And on the other hand, I have a new massive particle. And so just naively, I might imagine that could be a dark matter candidate. And it turns out, yes, it can be an interesting dark matter candidate. So there's experiments that we've been thinking about to probe both of these aspects. And I'm going to give you a quick picture of those experiments. So I'm going to start by talking about light through walls type searches for hidden photons, and a big parametric enhancement that we've realized that we're that's going to make these experiments a lot more sensitive than the experiments that have gone before. And before I come on to these light through walls type experiments, let me just I want to show you the existing parameter space. And existing constraints on hidden photons. And before I come to that, I just want to mention two points which are going to be important. They're very simple points. The first one is that all effects of the hidden photon decouple as its mass vanishes. Okay, if I dial its mass to zero, the effects decouple. From a particle physics picture, you can see that easily because you can diagonalize the Lagrangian in such a way that the hidden photon is totally decoupled. You can just see it in the Lagrangian. From the sort of classical electromagnetism picture, what happens now is I have two copies of electromagnetism, both infinitely long-ranged, both coupling in identical ways. Whenever I produce a field of one, I'm producing a field of the other, and I feel both fields in exactly the same way. So the net effect is just sort of slightly increasing the strength of electromagnetism, but the strength of electromagnetism is a measured parameter anyway. So, and we always measure when we measure it, we always measure the combined effect. So there's actually, it's impossible to tell that it's coming from two different fields.
Is this true?
Yes.
So is this true? So imagine that I get this epsilon from integrating out some heavy matter with this charge under what you want. Is this statement still true when you set the gamma? Is it true about all those really? Even in the UV condition? That you have not.
Well, it wouldn't be true if you're probing energies above the mass of that particle that you integrated out, of course. But if that's a heavy particle, then yes, I think it's true.
I also have a doubt about this statement because even if the mass goes to zero,
then if you have these distinguishable things, then you know your quantum statistics, you know the bosonic properties of my, for example, Z naught to gamma gamma is forbidden, you know, by quantum.
Yeah, but the second is not coupled to the method, so it cannot participate in these processes.
From the Lagrangian point of view, it's extremely easy to show that it decouples. And let me not spend any more time on it now, but I could show you after. Simple point number two: a hidden photon that's massive has two transverse modes, like the photon, but unlike the photon, which is massless, it also has one longitudinal mode, and that's very important. So now let me show you. Sort of the world that we're imagining. This is the parameter space of mass in electron volts, 10 to the minus 16 up to 0, corresponding on the top to the Compton length from micrometers up here down to ridiculously long scales down here. And epsilon, you know, I'm going from 1 to 10 to the minus 13 here. And so these gray regions are all ruled out by existing constraints from tests of Coulomb's law, CMB, photons converting into hidden photons. Very interesting, but I won't go into them. I just want to particularly highlight these bounds here, which are stellar cooling bounds, which Joseph mentioned in his talk. These are bounds from Haipeng, Maxime, and Joseph. I want to mention them particularly because previous to their work, the bounds from stellar cooling were thought to be much weaker. They were thought to sort of fall off like this and only constrain this region. What was pointed out in this paper was that that's what the previous bound was what you get if you only consider the transverse modes. The longitudinal modes couple more strongly, and that places much more strong bounds. This was unfortunate in a way because there was an experiment, the ALPS experiment, which was going to experimentally in the lab probe a region in here. That region has already been all ruled out, as Joseph mentioned. What I'm going to talk about is sort of the flip side of that, how we can use this enhanced coupling to improve our sensitivity in experiments that can be built. So let me talk about these light through walls experiments. So Sajid mentioned them briefly this morning. In the sort of dumbest form, the idea is that you have some source of electromagnetic fields, and then you put some sort of field sensor behind a shield. So in ordinary electromagnetism, that shield, which is, say, a superconductor, blocks out all these fields, and the field sensor sees nothing. But if I have a hidden photon, the hidden photon can leak through the shield, and I pick it up with the field sensor. So that's the very basic dumb idea. Now, it turns out that probably the best way to do this for hidden photons is by using resonant microwave cavities. And this was a scheme that was suggested by these authors. What you're going to do is you're going to have one microwave cavity, which you drive, so that has one particular mode which is driven very strongly. And I'm going to have another cavity which I don't drive at all, and I shield from the first cavity, but I'm going to make it so that the second cavity has a cavity mode at exactly the same frequency as the one that I'm driving. So with ordinary electromagnetism, no field should get out. The second cavity shouldn't be driven at all. But the hidden photon would actually be radiated from the first cavity, would penetrate into the receiver cavity, and excite it a little bit. So that's the basic scheme. Why are microwave cavities good? Well, you can get amazingly high resonant enhancement, Q factors around 10 to the 10. And cavities can be very precisely tuned to each other, which is, of course, important. They're naturally self-shielding. Of course, you can add your own shielding, but these are naturally self-shielding. And also, if you think about the masses they're probing, most strongly correspond to a set by the sizes of the cavities, which turns out to be a rather interesting range to probe. And some sort of early stage experiments have already been carried out, three of them by these groups. So this is already being done. I want to talk about the size of the signal and how this is actually going to be greatly enhanced from what was previously thought. So I'm going to start by talking about the signal size you would get if you just consider the transverse modes. And this is what's been considered before. Now, there are two transverse hidden photon modes and two transverse photon modes, and there's this mixing between them. And without going into the details, let me just say you can think about it a lot like neutrino oscillations, which means you can think about producing the interacting component. As it travels, it oscillates a little bit into the non-interacting component. Now, only the non-interacting component can pass through a shield, or in our case, can pass out of the cavities. But of course, you can't see the non-interacting component. It has to oscillate back into the interacting component to see it. So you pay a double penalty, one to oscillate into the hidden photon, and one to oscillate back. So the signal you see, you get a resonant enhancement. You pay two factors of epsilon. And importantly, I made the point that all signals fall off as the mass falls off. This signal here turns out to fall off as mass to the fourth. And I won't derive that, but that's how it turns out to fall off. And this is the signal size that was previously expected by the experiments that have run. What was missed was the longitudinal mode. Now, as I mentioned, you know, there is a longitudinal mode, and in general, it just will be produced. There's no reason to think it wouldn't. If you do a careful calculation, you see that it is produced. Its production is suppressed by the hidden photon mass. And you know that must be true because the hidden photon longitudinal mode only exists because there's a hidden photon mass. So its production had better fall off as I turn off the hidden photon mass. What happens is that you produce it goes straight through all shielding and gives you a signal in your, here I've done it with a test charge, but you get a signal in your second cavity. It turns out that signal is parametrically stronger than the signal from transverse modes. I'm not going to derive it for you, but the key difference is that while for the transverse modes, the signal strength falls off as mass to the fourth, for us it only falls off as mass squared with the longitudinal mode as the mass goes to zero. And this actually turns out to be a big effect. And so I'm going to show you now the limits set by the Crowes experiment. The Crowes experiment did this type of two-cavity setup. And this solid region is the bound that they believe that they'd placed. And actually, if you reanalyze their results, you see that they had a setup where they were optimized to produce transverse waves, but they also had another setup which was inadvertently optimized to produce longitudinal waves and to pick up longitudinal waves. And if you use that result, actually, the bound goes from the solid region up to the region above this straight line here. So this big region here gets excluded.
Jeremy?
Yes?
So what happens, do you ever calculate, because in principle, it's true that this putting the cavities like this is better than having them like this. Mm-hmm. But still, it's not perfectly like a beam, right?
That's right. So what they did, of course, already used the longitudinal mode slightly.
Yeah.
We didn't bother to calculate it because they had this setup. They had a different. No, we didn't bother because they had a setup that was already better and doing what we wanted.
Yeah.
So of course you can, you know, this experiment is only excluding this little tip down here anyway that wasn't already excluded. But the point is what we can do in the future. So we've been working with Sami Tantawi, Kento, and the experimentalists I mentioned earlier, and we're designing, and hopefully they're gonna run a better cavity experiment optimized to use these longitudinal modes. In a first fairly rudimentary room temperature experiment, we're hoping to get this sensitivity of the upper red dashed line. And then in a sort of stage two experiment, we're hoping to push it down much further. And here is where you really see the advantage of the longitudinal mode. If you just use the transverse modes, you get a bound that goes like this. So you're just excluding this region here. And we're opening up all this region, including this ridiculously light mass region here, all of this region here. So that's the exciting thing about longitudinal modes, and this is what we're hoping we'll be able to achieve with microwave cavity experiments. So I'm going to turn to hidden photon dark matter now, unless anyone has any questions about this.
Do you know what is Jupiter and Earth? Could you remind me?
They're from how the magnetic field profiles of the planets fall off as you move away from them, because now you've got two force carriers, but one's finite range. So once you sort of past the range of that force carrier, the magnetic field falls off in a different way. So you can see they're rather weak up at the top. But That's what they're from. Okay, so part two of my talk. What time did I start?
Well, you have 5 minutes.
I think I started a little later. I think I'm being robbed of time. I'll try and squeeze it in five and a bit, so ten. Part two is looking for hidden photon dark matter with a radio. Hidden photons is dark matter. Is this reasonable? Well, hidden photons are light, very light bosons. We're used to very light bosons being dark matter when we talk about axions. It's natural for axions to be very light because they're pseudoscalar, which means their mass is protected. But a vector, more specifically a hidden photon, is the other case of a boson whose mass can naturally be very light. So it's another very natural light boson to think about as dark matter. It would have a very high occupation number, which means you can think about it as a classical A prime field, oscillating at a frequency set by its mass, and pointing in some random direction. Okay, so that's a bit weird. That it's pointing in a direction breaking Lorentz invariance, but actually it turns out to be incredibly hard to tell that there's only Lorentz violation, so it's actually safe. And that was proposed by these authors. From an experimental point of view, what is this? Well, there's this hidden electric field. And it's everywhere in space around us, including inside shielding, everywhere, pointing in some random direction, with a size equal to 2,000 volts per meter, which is huge, of course, except we only feel it through the small parameter epsilon, which can be very small. And it's oscillating with a fixed frequency, and there's a frequency spread set by the local dark matter velocity to be about 10 to the minus 6. So this means that it can excite an electromagnetic resonator. Okay. Now, the obvious thing to think about is electromagnetic cavities. Just like the ADMX cavity is looking for axion dark matter by putting a big B field through a cavity. Well, for us, the B field is totally irrelevant. It plays no role, but ADMX is automatically already searching for this hidden photon dark matter. And that was pointed out by these authors. This is very powerful, except there's a downside, which is that the mass range you can probe is restricted by what size cavities you can build. They can only go from sort of this size to this size. And we want to probe many, many, many orders of magnitude and mass. So that's why we're interested in using LC circuits instead. LC circuits are electromagnetic resonators. They're basically just a radio. But you can build them to rather high Q, probably up to 10 to the 6, which is the ideal thing we'd like for this experiment. But with LC circuits, the resonant frequency isn't tied to the geometric size. And what that means is you can probe much, much lower frequencies and therefore lower masses than you could with cavities. So here's a cartoon of the setup. There's this oscillating hidden electric field through space pointing in some direction. We're going to take a tunable LC circuit, and we're going to stick it inside a metal box to shield it from all backgrounds. So we should think about what happens inside the box. So the E prime field exerts a slight force on the electrons, the conduction electrons in the box, and that causes them to move up and down. And that, in turn, causes production of ordinary E and B fields inside this box. And the net result of that, which I won't show you, I'll just tell you, is that the E field cancels out with the E prime field, so you don't experience an electric field inside, but there is a real B field inside. And that's the biggest effect that you get. The size of the B field is 10 to the minus 5 Tesla, which is relatively huge, suppressed by epsilon and suppressed by hidden photon mass times size of your box. And that's all there is to it, really. So we've been working with Kent Irwin and his student to design that experiment and build it, which is all happening right now. I'm going to show you the reach we think we can get, but first I just want to bring back the parameter space that I showed you before, but I'm going to have to add on now some new bounds. These are bounds on hidden photons as dark matter by these authors. The bound basically comes from hidden photons resonantly converting to plasma excitations, which can mess up various things, which I won't get into. But all of this tan shaded region is not possible as dark matter. All of the white region that's left is allowed for hidden photons as dark matter. And this red dashed curve sticking out is our hopeful reach with the cavity experiment. So you can see it's rather complementary. The cavity experiments, you know, probe lots of region in here, which isn't allowed as dark matter. The experiments we're going to have as dark matter are probing, going to be probing a lower region. So I'm just going to show you what we think we can do. First of all, these brown spikes is what's already excluded by ADMX with their cavity. And in blue is what we think we can do with this resonant LC circuit search. A stage one experiment, which is going to be sort of meter scale size, room temperature. Actually, we'll probably do two experiments to probe two different regions, one up here and one down here, corresponding to sort of up to around 100 megahertz frequency for one of them and sort of 100 kilohertz frequency for the other. If that works well, we can move to a stage two experiment, which would be cryogenic. And hopefully, we'd probably have to actually be broken up into several experiments, but would probe this bigger region down here, meeting up with the bounce from the cavities. So that's very briefly what we think we can do with these resonant LC circuit searches.
So I got confused. So if you go to the really like 10 minus 15 electron volts, you're saying that there are no strong bounds there?
Yes.
And then that range, like the electric field, effective electric field, if I multiply your previous number by epsilon, would be quite substantial, right?
Yeah, and I would.
Not limited, and the time variation is like 1 second.
I would agree that probably this bears more thinking about, and maybe there is some bound. But the reason we can't see it on Earth is because it's screened by any conductor, including the Earth. Which means that locally, its effect is, you know, actually vanishes. You'd have to go into deep space where it's not screened by anything. If I put a test charge in deep space, it might actually feel this.
People are planning to put, you know, atomic clocks on the orbit, right?
Yeah, and of course, you know, even deep space has ionized atoms in it, which causes gives some. It allows some screening. Actually, I'm not sure if
you want also your atomic clock outside of the satellite housing, because the satellite housing screens it. And you know, it's suppression by a size of satellite over that's a one second length scale, which is Earth moon distance.
I want to move on because I'm feeling pressure from my right to finish, and I have two more slides. I just want to quickly mention generating the dark matter abundance. I haven't mentioned anything about this, sort of the elephant in the room. For the axion, you know, there's very definite ways to understand how you get a dark matter abundance. But the hidden photon, this is rather underdeveloped. This is something we're working on it right now, and we suspect there's several ways to do it. I just want to quickly mention one rather novel possibility. I won't flesh it out. I'll just tell you the basics. The idea is, what happens is that dark matter is actually generated purely gravitationally. It's generated by inflationary fluctuations. It's a light field, just like inflationary fluctuations give you gravity waves and matter fluctuations. They give you fluctuations in light fields in general, including the hidden photon. But there's something unusual about the way the hidden photon evolves through, you know, from the beginning of the universe to now, which means that you suppress large-scale isocurvature fluctuations and just end up with a hidden photon field that has a lot of wiggles on a short scale that you can't see cosmologically. And that makes up all of the power in it, all of the matter, and actually looks totally normal, we think, to all dark matter, you know, cosmological observables.
And so is also randomly oriented.
And is randomly oriented everywhere. Yes.
What's the length scale of this random
orientation? The length scale is the dominant length scale is there's a special scale where a fluctuation of that size goes non-relativistic just as it enters the horizon, and that turns out to be the dominant length scale of this. Which turns out, so there's a particularly interesting thing if Bicep 2 should happen to be right. And, you know, this wasn't motivated by Bicep 2, it just falls into our lap. If Bicep 2 should happen to be right, that sets the size of the inflationary fluctuations. And then to get the right dark matter abundance, that fixes the mass, which corresponds to a frequency of about 100 megahertz, which is amazing because that's, you know, radio stations. It's perfect to look for with our LC oscillator circuit. In terms of the size of the length scale, that would be sort of solar system. No, a little, I forget, it was a little
which that is because it didn't expand.
Little smaller than solar system
size. It's bizarre size. It's sort of great.
It's sort of 1 AU-ish.
Not that small, not that big.
Sort of 1 AU-ish size, these fluctuations. If the inflationary scale is lower, that corresponds to a larger mass, and the mass goes up very quickly as the inflationary scale goes down. So I'm just going to show you that plot before, but I'm going to stick on this spike where if bicep 2 should happen to be right, this is where we want to look, and it falls right in falls right in where we're going to look with our stage 1 experiment. So that's potentially very exciting. So let me put up the conclusions and just leave it there. Thank you very much.